A big welcome to episode 6 of the Wild Edge podcast with me, Ollie France. I'm delighted today to introduce Tim Howell onto the podcast. When I was planning this podcast and thinking about the guests I would bring on, Tim was right at the top of the list, and so I'm delighted that he's joined me for an episode. Tim Howell is a former Marine. He is a base jumper. He's a wingsuit pilot. He has set records all over the globe. He has done countless new routes and new jumps. He's also an alpinist, and he is one of the most prolific, relentless adventurers that you are likely to see out there. And one of the big things that I really find inspiring about Tim is just how much he is getting after it with expedition after expedition out in the mountains all the time, really following his passion and really doing what he loves. So it was a pleasure to speak with Tim, and in this conversation we're going to talk about fear, we're going to talk about risk, we're going to talk about group pressures, and also we're going to hear some amazing anecdotes from Tim's world of work in base jumping. I have no doubt that you are going to enjoy this episode. It really is something special. I want to say a big thanks to everybody who has continued to download and listen to the podcast. I'm glad to see, as that we're now reaching the 6th episode, that every week the subscriber list is growing, and I'm seeing that now the podcast is being downloaded in new countries every week, so you're all very welcome here. Adventure, as I've said before, speaks all languages. It is for all people, I believe, and I do think that whatever field of work, whatever life we lead, we can all learn lessons from adventure. And it is my aspiration to provide you with plenty of inspiration and insightful stories with the Wild Edge podcast. So thank you. If you do enjoy the episodes, I'd love for you to hit subscribe if you haven't already, and share it around with friends on social media, with anybody you think might find these stories exciting, enlightening, entertaining. Please do share it around. Organic growth, of course, and word of mouth is the very best way to grow anything, I believe, any product, and this podcast is no different. So I'm really grateful for your help. All right, I think it's time to get into my conversation with extraordinary world record breaking base jumper Tim Howell. Tim Howell, welcome to the Wild Edge podcast.
Thank you very much. Yeah, nice to be here, dude. Nice to have a good chat with you.
Definitely. Yeah, good to make it happen. I want to dive straight into a bit of a scenario to kick us off, and I want to picture you stood on top of a new exit. Yeah. You've got a big vertical drop below you, maybe people around you or other things going on. But in those seconds leading up to you jumping off that point of no return, how is your body responding to the situation and what's going through your mind?
Yeah, so funnily enough, you mentioned a big drop. It's scarier if the drop's smaller.
Yeah, interesting.
So recently we just came back from a trip to Sweden in the Arctic Circle. And we traveled 68 kilometers to get to the exit point. And as soon as I stood on the exit point, I was like, oh, it's easy. It's huge. We carry lasers to measure how big the drop is. And yep. In this case, I didn't even use a laser, because you can throw a rock, count how many seconds. And if it's above 5, 6, 7, 8 seconds is huge. There's no need to be that accurate when it's that big. So yep. That actually put my nerves to rest. So although that was a new exit point for me, I was relatively chilled and confident and knew the outcome.
Yeah.
When there's a lot more variables, things like landing areas that you have to reach, or rock outcrops that you have to fly over, such as the case in Scotland or Kenya, when I open new wingsuit exits there, that's when it really starts coming down to a numbers game and calculating what you're capable of doing and really looking at yourself and thinking, is a risk worth the reward? And do I have enough margin of error to be able to outfly those numbers? So that's when it gets a bit more spicier. And I've got to think about it a bit more.
So would you still be asking yourself that question, is the risk worth the reward, in those final few seconds? Or at that point, are you just into a methodical process where you're going and that's it?
In the final few seconds, I've definitely made my mind up way before then. If in the final few seconds you're making your mind up, then something's really gone wrong and you shouldn't be at that exit point. A quote that I sort of live by from military times and since then, and I still use it a lot, is a recce is seldom wasted.
Yeah.
So in the case in Scotland, I went to the exit point the day before without my parachute, so I knew exactly where I was going to put my feet. I measured it, I calculated it, I walked down to the landing, I sat there just absorbing the surroundings. So the next day I knew what to expect. There were a lot of variables that were taken away because I knew where I was going to put my foot. I was at ease with standing there on the edge. I knew the angle which I was going to push at and where I was going to land and where I was going to fly. So in that case, for me, a recce was not wasted. And it means my mind is made up way before, you know. So when I come there to do the job, to do the jump, my mind is just focused on the task.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I mean, I think that shows the level of planning and control that goes into these jumps. And before we sort of get more into that, I just want to take a bit of a backward step and figure out, you know, what makes you tick? What made you get into this sort of high-risk game, I suppose? Were you one of these kids who was, you know, itching to get out of a classroom and taking risks as a youngster?
Yeah, for sure. Maybe that's something that all base jumpers started with, you know, climbing around roofs on the school after hours, or I don't know, like a lot of little things, like growing up, definitely taking risks from an early age. And I think my dad definitely helped me kind of discover that risk versus reward and kind of had confidence in my own abilities. I suppose it wasn't really a normal childhood. But when you grow up, you find new hobbies, you do new things, and that definitely transpired to jumping off big cliffs all around the world.
Yeah, it's interesting to really read about your background, and I know that you were out in South Africa as a learned this recently as a safari guide, which I suppose that, you know, you see that career and think, well, that's total freedom. You're out there in the African bush, you know, with the big animals. And after that, I know that you of course went into the Royal Marines, but there does seem a slight disparity between that desire for freedom and then heading out into a military setting. I wonder what your mindset was there with joining the Royal Marines at that stage.
Yeah, I mean, I think people like myself, we don't really like authority and being told what to do, which is such a difference. So hypocritical and ironic that we end up joining the military or whatever. But I think the one thing that kind of comes across with everything I do is just a challenge, you know. So I left South Africa because the recession hit, so we weren't getting much tips. Jacob Zuma came into power, made it hard to renew my visa, and there was some issues with certain people, death threats and stuff. So that's another story. So it was a good time for me to leave, and I decided the Marines is the next big challenge. So everything to me, the motivation comes down to the fact that it's a challenge.
Yeah, Yeah. And when you look back at your time in the Royal Marines, what are some of the things that do stick with you now that you know you find valuable in what you do?
Yeah, I mean when you talk about what I do now with the mountaineering and the base jumping, it's never really the direct skills that I took, like the physical skills that I took from the Marines, although there's definitely some overlap. Because I was doing a lot of the base jumping and mountaineering at the same time, as my career in the Marines.
Yeah.
But it's really the mental side of things, knowing that no matter what I come up against, I can potentially just crack on and try and persevere. With all the different survival exercises and escape and survival and resistance and in all the different environments that we've done it in as well, I think they're just the determination just to carry on, which I've definitely been in situations since in the mountains where I think some people might have had a different reaction to the situation they're in, whereas if you're calm and you can just persevere a little bit of hardship, then you're good to go for another few days.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose that's where experience takes over. And I'm kind of interested in this relationship between experience and your instincts, where, you could be out with a less experienced group of people, for example, and everyone's having a great time, unaware perhaps that something's going on and it may not be fully perceptible. You know what I mean? You're in a situation, but you just, as you build those layers of experience, you just get these senses sometimes that something is a little off. Is that something 100%. You've experienced?
Yeah, 100%. And that's something, maybe gut feeling or sixth sense. But I don't think that's gained from experience. I think that's subconscious information that we've either seen or smelt or remembered or seen out the corner of our eye. That's not necessary, tangible, and we're putting our finger on it saying that is the reason why I'm not going down that road, for example. But it's our experiences have led us to that decision, and it's somewhere in our subconscious where, as I said, whether it's just something that you've seen out of your corner eye or something you smell or heard, and that's the reason why you're not doing it. So I don't think sixth sense or gut feeling is like this mythical thing. I think it's a real real thing that can save your life at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. And it is interesting how that sort of guides what you do when you're out in those risky situations.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
It's something I've experienced too. But I mean, thinking, I suppose, a little bit deeper about that kind of group mentality when you are with other people in potentially high risk situations. And, quite specifically when it relates to base jumping. And I suppose from my perspective, I spend a lot of time with people who are traveling, off to Mogadishu and Kabul and Tripoli. And you spend enough time with those people and it becomes normalized, these risks, I suppose, become normalized. And you almost need to stop yourself and think sometimes, well, am I prepared to take that risk? Is this something I'm comfortable with? Is that a debate that you have with yourself when you're heading out into the mountains with a group? And I suppose, what other group factors do you notice, when you're in teams?
Yeah, I mean, I don't do much in a group. I definitely don't do much solo. I'm not that motivated to do stuff by myself, whether that's because I want a second opinion or because I need somebody to share that experience with. I don't do much by myself, but I definitely don't do much in large groups. I'm not a people person. I don't like people. So I normally like two or three or four max, but on a hard route in the Alps or something that I consider hard, you're not taking many people on it. It's just your climbing partner and yourself. But I think what you're saying as well is people build up a tolerance to risk, and that's maybe from doing it so much So you're so current at taking on risk, and that's when it's the most dangerous. And that happens a lot with wingsuiting. So at the end of the season, people have had a whole, 3 months of just nailing wingsuit jumps every single day. So they're so current that actually being current is the most dangerous, because they're more willing to take risks.
Yeah, interesting. You mentioned something there that I think is worth picking up on, that you mentioned you're not particularly a people person, you said, and you like to get out and do solo things. And it just made...
No, sorry, I'm not motivated to do solo. Like, I need a wingman.
Yeah, but what I was coming on to really was when you think about wingsuiting, it almost is the ultimate solo practice, isn't it? It's literally you controlling everything around you. Yeah. And just wondering if that sort of feeds into you.
It's not a team
you.
Game, for sure. I'm definitely not into a team game. So the actual activity is solo. But, I'll share the experience with friends. Sometimes you have friends flying with you. And I'll almost always be on an exit point with somebody else, and you can jump separately, obviously. And for the most demanding jumps, high in the Alps or really technical jumps, you'll fly solo just so you can concentrate on yourself. You're right. It's not a team sport, that's for sure.
I wonder when base jumping first came onto your radar. Was it a picture? Was it a film? Was it a conversation you had? What put it on your radar? And did you feel an instant pull, like, I want to do this?
So I think the first time I actually saw it was maybe when I was like 13 or something. And it was a picture in like FHM or something like that. And I didn't really think that much of it. But then as I grew up, maybe around 16 to 18, when you start saving some money because you've got a weekend job or whatever, I started saving up for an AFF course, a skydiving course. And that was with the sole intention of becoming a base jumper. I had no interest of redoing as much skydiving as possible. It was just enough to do the course. And then when I had about 50 skydives, I went on a climbing trip to Tonsai in Thailand.
Yeah.
And I called it training for the Marines, because climbing does get me fit. I could run on the beach every day, I could climb every day, and I did actually get quite fit. But it's an absolute mecca, Tonsai, for climbing and for base jumping.
Right.
So somebody wanted sort of a guide to take them to the top of this exit point. And I was more than happy to, with the sort of intention of, do you reckon I could borrow your parachute and also go for a jump? Which was obviously, in hindsight, never going to happen. But it was it's a lovely lady called Prue Beams that I still chat to every now and again. And that was the first time I saw a base jump in real life. And it was, I was just fixated to do a course from then on.
So what came next, I suppose? Was it a methodical process? Did you think, okay, I need to go and get some training and I need to do some more skydives? What were the steps you took from that point, from that, image in your mind to, I want to do this, to actually getting out and base jumping?
So I had 50 skydives at that point, and I knew I needed around 200 for somebody to accept me on a course. So I calculated how many weekends I'd need if I did, 5 or 10 jumps each weekend. And I thought, in a year, I will be skydiving. I will be base jumping. It actually took me 2 years because I realized skydiving for me wasn't the most fun. And actually, the parties at the drop zones are a lot more interesting. And so it took me 2 years, but 2 years to the day. So on my 21st birthday, I started skydiving. And on my 23rd birthday, I was base jumping. And then I didn't really do that many more skydives after I started base jumping.
And when you were in the Marines, there were no contractual things where they're like, okay, Tim, you're gonna have to rein in the base jumping now?
To be honest, I always had good hierarchy, good bosses, good sergeants, good color sergeants. So I did a deployment 6 months on an ice breaking ship. That went from South Africa to the Falklands to Antarctica to Rio, and where else did we? And Chile. And it was resupplying in between Antarctica and Chile and all sorts. And I took my base rig with me. And luckily, I had a very good colour sergeant that was very on board with me jumping off whatever I wanted to. So I got to jump in all those different countries. I nearly got to jump in Antarctica, actually. Wow. That was the one country I was missing. But yeah, maybe one day I'll go back.
Yeah. Have there been any jumps in Antarctica?
There has, yeah. Yeah. A Russian dude called Valery Rozov, he jumped a huge cliff called Altavina. Something like that.
Okay. Yes. Yeah.
So in Queen,
really impressive. I've seen the mountain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he years and years ago, quite a few people have jumped since actually. But when he jumped, he had like those down mittens and he said his hands were just so numb. He was so scared he couldn't pull the parachute. So that's not quite a scary feeling. Wow.
Yeah, I suppose at this point it might be useful to actually, for anyone listening who doesn't know, just explain what base jumping actually is, if you wouldn't mind.
So BASE is an acronym for Building Antenna Span and Earth, but it doesn't just limit it to those. Like a wind turbine doesn't actually come into those, but it's still a base jump. A base jump is a parachute jump from a static object. So not a plane or a hot air balloon or a helicopter. And you can get really creative. You can jump off Alton Towers, theme park rides, and all sorts of crazy things. But for me, I love the mountains, and most of my jumps have been off cliffs and in the mountains. And you get two types of jumps. You get subterminal, where you jump off and your parachute pretty much comes out straight away. And you can do that with somebody holding your parachute if it's really low. I've jumped as low as 26 meters where somebody's either held my parachute as I've jumped out or I've used static line that breaks. And then you can go handheld where you've got the pilot chute, like what somebody would call a drogue, but it's called a pilot chute, and you throw it as you jump. And then you do the typical one, which is stowed. So you reach back and throw that drogue.
Yeah.
And you do that to around like 200 meters. And then after that, 300 meters and above, you can go terminal velocity. So it's where your body reaches terminal velocity. And that's really where you can start to fly your body. So you can track or wingsuit. And in the wingsuiting, we can reach speeds of, typically I fly at like 180 kilometers an hour. but people have done like 300. And then at the end of your wingsuit flight, you can flare. So you can actually gain altitude.
Oh really?
A lot of modern suits, yeah. I think the record at the moment is like 110 meters flare in a wingsuit. And then you reach the stall point and you can deploy your parachute and then land on your parachute. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, there's so many elements there. And I suppose I'm just thinking about you in the situation you were in. So you got your base jumping course. And I suppose from that point, you must have seen a whole world of opportunities. You know, are you somebody who kind of takes inspiration from lots of different places? You maybe got a map lots of images. Yeah. And, what's going through your mind once you start base jumping, you know? Are you suddenly coming up with a big tick list of objectives?
I've got a huge tick list. My notebook is just full of ideas. Yeah. And, you know, for a while it became a real motivation to try and find wingsuit jumps in countries that have never been jumped in before.
Yeah.
So I did Kenya, Vietnam, Scotland, or UK. So I'm still searching for those, but sometimes those trips take 2 or 3 years. You know, Vietnam took 2 trips over 3 years to organize it all and make sure that the cliff was jumpable and even reach it. So, but yeah, there's, and I love all the different types, the really low stuff to the high wingsuit jumps, the buildings, and I love it all. So it's, yeah, I've got a logbook of, that I write down exactly what jump it was and who I jumped with, and it's split 50-50 between wingsuit jumps and normal jumps without the wingsuit. So.
Yeah. I'm interested to know where your inspiration comes from. You know, whether people are base jumping or mountain climbing or trekking or cycling, it involves inspiration at some point.
Yeah.
So for you, is it conversations? Is it images? Is it films? You know, is it meticulous research?
Dare I say it, Instagram.
Yeah, fair enough.
I mean, the pictures that you see on there, and again, I've got a folder of them of and split into different countries of just like, wow, somebody's taking this beautiful landscape photo of this cliff and it is phenomenal and I want to go there. And but that's really where the research and the planning starts, because that happened for Vietnam. It was just a single picture of this huge limestone cliff. And now I need to know the height of it. So I can find Google street images of people next to it, and I can estimate, oh, it's at least 150 meters, so that's worth it. Access, is it just a jungle out the back? So then I can look at mapping, hiking maps and stuff, and figure out whether there's access. And then the landing, like on Google Earth, you can map the gradient of the terrain. So can I outfly it? Can I reach the landing? And strangely enough for that one, it was a seasonal landing. It was in like a cornfield. So the first time I went there, there wasn't any landing. It was on a riverbank. But it got rained off. Like, it was a huge thunderstorm for like a week, so I couldn't jump it anyway. But when I returned, there was no crops, and I could land on the mud, and it came together perfectly.
Thinking about base jumping, you know, it's often seen as sort of an illegal pursuit in some corners of the world. I wonder if you've ever had any run-ins with the authorities.
Yeah. I mean, the way I always describe it is, if you break into a building and play football on the roof, playing football is illegal as well. You know, it's
yeah.
So, yeah, there are some states in America where base jumping is illegal, but it's more of a trespass issue. And if you trespass playing football, that's still illegal. National parks in America have made it illegal, but they've also paragliding and hang gliding as well. So, I had some undercover policemen in Morocco hold me for a little bit, which while they were chatting away on their phones, it was a bit exciting, but I put the SD card in the side of my mouth, and so I thought, if they confiscate the cameras, at least I've got some fun footage. But and then where else? I had like some building jumps in the UK. The police have questioned me, but when they realise I'm not burglaring the place with a big bag full of what looks like burgled gear, they're just like, "Oh wow, how high was it? Where'd you land?" Like they love it. So I've never really had any issues in the UK.
I know that you do some events, and you were out in Saudi, was it? Was it Neom?
Yeah.
How was that? Yeah. I mean, I keep on hearing about this place, Neom, in Saudi. I suppose there's a lot of marketing going on there. What was that event all about, and how did you get involved?
It was really cool, actually. It was so I've jumped and climbed in the Wadi Rum before, and actually it's probably only a couple of hundred kilometers away, because it's right on the border. So the rock is very, very similar. But as an event, it was amazing, because they invited, I think, something like 100 local climbers. And that's pretty much the climbing community is only that small. So everyone knew each other. And it was so amazing to see how small and how close the climbing community was. Because, you know, the worldwide base jumping community is very small. So, you know, I can bump into Aussies and Americans and stuff anywhere else in the world, and we'll come together and we know each other, or at least know somebody that's a close friend. And that just seemed like that for the climbing community in Saudi. We got invited over as a bit of an exploratory team to climb some new routes that would lead into the base jumps. And it was, an incredible week living in the desert. Glamping, actually. It was
I can imagine in Saudi they don't do things by halves.
No corners cut.
I wonder how many, or if you've got a sense of how many base jumpers are actually out there. You mentioned it's a small number.
So it's a hard one, because what constitutes as a base jumper? Is it somebody that jumps as often as they can, or is it somebody that's jumped 5 times a year, or 10 years ago they did 20 jumps or 100 jumps and they never jumped again? Like, so I would say a base jumper is somebody that maybe jumps like 50 times a year at least, sort of thing. And in the UK, I would say there's maybe 100, maybe 200. There's a base number. So once you complete building antenna span and earth, you can apply for a base number, and that's I think in around 2,500 now.
Right,
but that's not accurate in the slightest. You know, it's a very American thing, so not a lot of Europeans do it. But yeah. Also, it doesn't account for the people who have died or have stopped base jumping and the people who haven't done it. So there are no real statistics, to be honest. It's pretty rough.
Yeah. Do you see it as a competitive sport, or is it seen as competitive?
No, not at all. And I think that's maybe one of the definitions of competition, of a sport, is that it needs to be competitive. And you can make it competitive, but it's not what the sport's about. So for a normal base jump, the only way of really making it competitive is accuracy, landing, which is boring. It's definitely not what we get excited about. And then when you start making wingsuiting competitive, you definitely can, you know, skydive, wingsuiting, you can make very competitive. There's performance, glide, artistic, you know, the height of the flare, accuracy, hitting targets. You can make it very, there's lots of different disciplines, speed and everything. But if you start doing that in a base jumping environment, you're pushing the risk quite high. So it hasn't really, it's been explored a little bit, but it hasn't really took off.
Yeah. So that's not something you, that's not one of your motivations.
No, and to be honest, I'm not good at it. So I haven't skydived wingsuit that much. And that's really where you get your, get those sort of skills up. So for me, it's about exploration and, you know, trying to do creative, new, for me, interesting jumps. So there's like an online leaderboard of who's flown the fastest and things like that. And that's, you know, what some of the numbers, as I said earlier, 333 kilometers an hour, I think one of them, which is just insane.
Wow.
But I'm not going to be doing that anytime soon.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty fast. I want to talk about your relationship with fear. You know, you're somebody who's now done hundreds of skydives all across the world. You know, you've done loads of new routes, done plenty of world records. And I read somewhere that on a normal jump, you don't really experience fear. What are your thoughts on fear? What's your relationship with it? And what steps do you take to stay calm in what most people would find a terrifying situation?
Yeah, I think you've got to rationalize it straight away. And if it's something that you can't change, then there's no point worrying about it. Worrying about it will just make things worse. And I suppose that's, you know, the cooler heads prevail. And it's, I think that definitely helps me in the mountains. You know, if I'm stuck in a storm or something like that, there's nothing I can do. When it comes to base jumping, if my heart's beating a million miles an hour, I'm not focusing on the job in hand, you know, I'm not shouting and going, whoa, yeah, let's do it, and listening to the music that's pumping me up, I'm just focusing. And breathing techniques I do find can help with my heart rate, and now I can just focus and visualize. But yeah, fear,
yeah,
you know, keeps you alive. It's good to have a healthy amount of fear, but
yeah,
if you're too scared that your heart's beating so fast, you're really not focused, and that's when things start going wrong.
So it seems, I mean, like many things, it's all about gaining control in the pursuit of base jumping. And it's something I've thought about a lot over recent years, is when I personally started to get into expeditions and go out into remote places, I found myself, I hadn't planned for it too well. You didn't know what I was doing too much, and I was just reacting to these situations. Whereas now I put a lot of time and thought into the planning stages so that I can anticipate what's going to come and visualize it. And I wonder if you've thought about that balance between reacting to situations and building this mental image that you can anticipate what comes in front of you.
Yeah, I think visualization has a huge part to play. If that's slightly what you mean, I think that's maybe what I would do in wingsuiting in terms of planning ahead for a trip or something, but visualization is something that that I do in wingsuit, and sometimes it can be counterproductive actually. Like, what's that saying? Something like, visualization is manifestation, or something like that. And
yeah,
I've got an example when I did my first vintage wingsuit jump, and I wore gloves, and it was snowing, it was cold. I kind of needed those gloves, so I didn't do like Valerie Rozoff, where my hands are so numb I can't pull my wingsuit. And I was thinking, you know, I don't like the feel of these gloves. Can I feel the toggle? It's a different feeling. And I just kept on thinking about it the whole walk up to the exit point. And I jumped off, I flew with my wife. And when I reached back, I don't know whether I missed it or just felt different. And I started to tumble a little bit. I couldn't reach my pull for my parachute.
Wow.
I went back into the flight. I took that split second breather, and then I went back and I pulled my parachute. And that's the only time that's ever happened. And that really, to me, told me that visualization turned into, you know, manifestation. It turned into what I was visualizing.
Yeah.
So that can be a negative thing.
Interesting.
But now I use it as a positive thing. You know, you're just visualizing how it should go.
It's so interesting when you describe that you had the composure when you started to tumble a little bit to move your hand back to the front, to take a second to pause and then go again. I mean, that is something which, to me, a novice, you know, may not have the composure to do that. And I suppose that's another thing which maybe comes with experience. Yeah.
But then maybe you don't get to that point where you're flying wingsuits off cliffs in winter without experience.
Yeah, so, also a good point. Have you got to be aware of or conscious of summit fever, or I suppose you'd call it jump fever? And, you know,
yes,
many of these goals, sure, they're big, they're multi-year goals. You could, you know, plan it for years, climb up the mountain, etc. What are your thoughts on that one?
So I'm quite proud of saying I've walked away from a lot of, like, for me, high profile jumps. So I was recently in Kilimanjaro, where we were trying to find an exit, and the cloud and the wind wasn't right, and we had probably rushed to the summit, so acclimatization wasn't good. And, you know, after however many days, 5 days, and all the money and effort of getting there, and we said, no, we're not going to jump. So it's never a bad decision to say you're not going to jump. You know, it's, if you walk down at the end of the day, you're walking, so it's a good outcome. But it definitely does happen to some people. But for me, I find it quite easy to walk away, to be honest. I've done it multiple times. Like the Matterhorn, I've been up there twice now trying to wingsuit from the summit, and both times been winded out, and I'm more than happy to say no, it's not favorable conditions.
I think it's interesting in the sport of base jumping and mountaineering as well, I suppose, that failure is something that could be celebrated. I remember I was doing a course with some the guy leading it was a very experienced mountain guide, and he was asking the group, how many of you had turned away from the summit once and a few hands went up, or twice, or 10 times? And he said, well, good for you, because the mountains, you know, it's no place for ego, is it? And I think that's, yeah, again, maybe something which does come from experience, learning that, okay, it's okay to walk away, and we can celebrate those smart decisions in high risk situations.
Yeah, too right, man. It should be like, it definitely should. There has been times where jumping has been the lesser of two evils, of being stuck on the mountain for the night or whatever. So
go on, you're going to have to give us an example of that.
There was a couple of years ago, I was trying to do a ski base from the north face of the Eiger. And the access is really easy in the summer, but in the winter, it's iced up. There are these, you know, like just thinly covered ice ledges. The rope on one section, they've got fixed ropes, but they're all frozen. So you can't abseil off them, and you can't really use them to climb up. So I managed to get to the exit point. There wasn't enough snow there to do a ski base. So I spent hours trying to push the snow and make it work. It just wasn't working. But this time it was like 4 or 5 o'clock at night. There's no way I would have got down in daylight on top of getting down safely with the iced up ledges and the iced ropes and stuff. Yeah. So it's something I'd thought about And this is what I think you kind of asked earlier as well about planning or, you know, looking into the future and seeing if there's anything you can do to mitigate. And I thought, well, if this situation ever happens to me, I'm up there with skis. I can't get down. I need to jump, but I can't ski off off the cliff to a ski base. So I attach the skis horizontally to my chest with some slings, and I did a handheld jump. It's something I thought about, so I was prepared for it. What I didn't foresee happening was there were attached for a single pivot point on my chest.
Yeah.
So as I fell, the skis kind of caught up with me, and as my parachute opened, it smacked into my face. Luckily, it hit my helmet. But if it had been like 2 inches lower, then yeah, I would have had a cut across my face or broken nose or something. But so that's something I learned from, but also an example of like the lesser of two evils. I still think I made the right decision.
I mean, this is another strand of it, isn't it? Of base jumping is the ski base, as you said. And I saw a very, very cool clip of yours on a glacier. I couldn't remember where it was, but you were sort of ski basing off of what looked like a huge Sirac. Where was that one? Is that a big project?
It was something I've been looking for years, probably since I started. My 21st base jump was a ski base. And 100% the inspiration came from Shane McConkie and JT Holmes. And in Shane McConkie's movie, I can't remember the name of the movie, but you know, it talks about his death and everything. It shows one clip of him jumping off a Sirac. And I just thought that would be a dream jump. So I spent years looking for them and trying to measure certain ones around the Alps. And then finally thought of this one. And obviously they're really scary places to be, let alone be on the edge. So we used a drone to measure it. And then when I came back, we made some ice screw anchors, kind of abseiled in so we could laser the edge. And and went for it. And it was, it was one of my top jumps for me. Like, it was just a really cool experience. And then we've done it twice since. And every time we come back, the cliff is different, just as the nature of Siracs. Like, it's a little bit lower, or there's now a crack in it, or it's changed direction. So it's always different. It's always a different exit point, which is pretty crazy.
So when you ski base, then are you then? Well, I suppose you're flying with the skis on, or you're parachuting down with the skis on, and then you're landing, hopefully on a decent enough slope to carry on skiing.
Yeah, I mean, you can land on flat or whatever, but it makes a really nice landing. Because instead of, you know, hitting hard and running it off, you're just skiing it out, and it's real smooth. So it's a different experience than normal base jumping, because with a normal base jump, you get to that point of no return, you push out and you're immediately falling. Whereas with ski base, you're, you know, pushing off the cliff at 30, 40 kilometers an hour. So you push out and you get that hang time before you start falling. And just to be like, just to have that hang time, you know, 100, 200 meters above the ground and then start falling with skis on is pretty cool.
Wow. I would like to tap into that. I mean, I know we've talked a lot about risk and fear and stuff, but what is the reward for you? What is it that keeps on drawing you back?
The challenge, to be able to come up with a challenge, to plan it, to, you know, navigate through the risk, mitigate the risk. There's so much to the planning, like that one. It took me years to find it, and then I had to measure it, and then to be able to execute it and pull it off without any troubles. You know, I'm not going to say perfectly, but without, you know, any major snags. It's all part of it.
Oh, nice. Well, I mean, one of the things I love about following what you do is just the relentlessness of your big goals that you're getting after. I mean, every week you seem to be doing something insane. And it's really inspiring to see the pace at which you operate.
Buddy. It's just, for me, just like one thing leads to another, you know, and it's,
yeah.
And I always call it like the projects like stepping stones. So, you know, my first ski base, I did really with not so much base jumping knowledge, but then that leads you to a different thing. And then maybe a ski tour to a ski base, and then a Serac ski base. And then the Serac ski base leads me to like a high altitude. Like they're all just little stepping stones that lead to bigger and bigger things. So it's putting all the pieces together to kind of come up with a bigger project each time.
Awesome. Another big project you're working on at the minute is the six North Faces of the Alps, which maybe you can introduce it and let us know where you're up to with the project.
I mean, it's taken maybe 7 years, but I started when I was in the Marines, and my first North Face that I climbed was the North Face of the Eiger. And then when I was climbing the North Face, you can see this feature called the Mushroom, which is this like standalone pillar. It's an incredible feature, but it's actually quite an easy base jump. So I thought, well, I've climbed it, you know, next week I can literally go and jump it. It's not that much of a big deal. It's accessible and it's a big, safe jump. And then I thought, well, there's all these other North Faces. There's Trecheim, Pisbadil, Grand Jurasse, Matterhorn, Pisbadil. Did I say Pisbadil?
Yeah.
Anyway, there's six of them in total.
Yeah.
Most of them had been jumped on one face or another, the South Face or the North Face. Most of them had been wingsuited. So I thought, well, maybe I can climb them all and wingsuit them all. And I don't think anyone else has done that before. So it's an ongoing project, but I've got two more to do. So, and it hasn't necessarily been climbing and jumping straight away, because the conditions are different for jumping and for climbing. So sometimes I can keep my base rig at the summit so I can climb it and jump down straight away. Others I have to return, you know, in the summer or something like that. So I've got the North Face of the Matterhorn to jump, but I've climbed the North Face, and I've got the North Face of Grand Jurasse to climb, but I have jumped it. So,
wow. Yeah. I know you mentioned before you've been up the Matterhorn twice now, but haven't done the jump yet. Mm. To what extent have you planned that? I know that there were windy conditions on the days you were up there, but you mentioned before knowing exactly where your feet are going to be planted, knowing, I suppose, your landing area. Is that all planned for the Matterhorn?
Regrettably not. No, the exit point is down, I think it's the east face, and then you fly to the north or the south into Italy if you want. And the day we were up there with our rig ready to jump, the whole climb up there'd been no wind, and we hit the summit ridge and it was really, really gusty. And we straight away were like, oh, well, this isn't going to happen. And strangely enough, two of our friends had just climbed the Hornley Ridge and were about to jump. And this also ties in with what you were saying earlier, being able to say no. We saw our two friends jumping, and we still said, no, that's not within our limits of risk. It's not for me. So I don't think you can ever tell other people what their limits of risk are. You can give a friendly advice, but I'm definitely not condoning that they shouldn't have jumped or anything like that. You know, that's up to them. But for me and my friend, Ed, we said, no, not today. And I do regret not going down to the exit point to at least see, you know, what it was about. But I think at that point, after I don't know how many hours climbing, because we did it in one push from the valley, we were just like, well, if we're not jumping, we're going to go straight back down and get to bed.
Well, no doubt you'll get it done. You touched on another thing there, which I found quite interesting, which was, you know, you looking at them and thinking, okay, that's not quite for us. I imagine that's something you've had to deal with as well, where lots of people are looking at what you do and maybe imposing their own perceptions of risk on you. Is that something 100%. You've had to deal with?
And then sometimes I call it out online, because there's obviously forums and stuff, and I see other people talking about other people, saying, what are you doing that for, you idiot? That's I'm like, how can you, at the end of the day, we're all jumping off cliffs for fun.
Yeah.
So we don't have to be doing any of it. So I don't understand how people can impose their limitations of risk or what is worth doing, worthwhile, or on other people. That just boggles my mind, especially in the sport where we just do not need to be doing it for any reason whatsoever. But,
That was something I spoke with Ben Saunders about actually on episode one, where he was describing that sometimes people can say these things, and maybe it more relates to close family members or friends, where their intentions could be good, or sometimes they maybe don't want you to be doing these constant achievements because maybe it's looking them look bad, actually, which was quite an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, I think in these high risk activities, there's a lot of egos flying around. So it's not always just what people say, it's why they're saying it and the meaning behind it is, we've all got egos. So,
quite a specific one. I know that once you're up at altitude, the air pressure is very different. And I suppose there's different things you need to factor in there. How much has high altitude, or really high altitude base jumping, been developed? Is that something that has been done? Is it something you've got aspirations to do?
For sure. Yeah, I've slowly been raising the altitude at which I jump. The wingsuit exit I opened in Kenya was just touching 5,000, I think. So that's the highest I've jumped. Jumped quite a few, around 4,000 meters in the Alps. And then Valery Rozov, the Russian dude that I was talking about earlier, his record, or the world record, was, I think, 7,800 meters.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So it does, obviously, the lack of the thinness of the air has a part to play in the pressurization of the wingsuit. But for me, the percentage that has is negated by the huge margin for error that I have. So I don't really consider it that much, just because I have a big margin for error. So if it takes away a fraction of that, then I've still got a big margin.
And is that with regards to just the nature of climbing a big 8,000er or something like that, and all the risk that carries in itself, when you talk about your margin for error?
Margin for error in terms of the flight itself. But I think it's sort of the measurements in the flight. So that's really what makes a jump technical, is the start, how quickly you have to pressurize your suit to fly away from the wall.
I see,
But I think being fatigued and, tired, I think that would have a huge part to play in having a margin for error on the exit point. Because some exit points are so big, you could just flop off it and you'd be fine. Where others, you really have to dial in the perfect push, trajectory, angle of attack. The timing at which you open your wings and the wingsuit inflates, everything has to be spot on for it to be like the most efficient start.
I want to ask you a question which I asked Richard Browning, actually, my previous guest. He also happens to be an ex-Royal Marine, and he likes to fly around, although on a jet suit instead of a wingsuit. But I asked him what it feels like when you forget everything around you and it's just you and the wingsuit and you're whizzing through the air. Is it almost like a flow state, or what's going through your mind in those moments?
Yeah. Everyone loves that buzzword, don't they?
They do, yeah. It's a good one.
I think for me, flow state, I've only really acknowledged it or been in that state when climbing. Climbing scares me a lot more than wingsuiting base jumping. Because it's that constant focus, the 20 minutes, hours, days. So when I'm lead climbing, I'm not that good a climber. I don't climb super high grades or anything. But when I am climbing, I can tell that when I'm completely confident in just trying as hard as I can, that I enter this flow state and I'm just going for it, instead of thinking, what happens if I fall here? That's when I'm not in the flow state. But for wingsuiting, for me, it's start. I think it's more intuitive. It's, you know, all the steering and everything is very intuitive. And maybe the muscle memory from the exit and the pull and flying your parachute. So it's really just focus, and it's just not as much flow state as I describe when I climb. And it doesn't happen often when I climb. Normally I'm shitting myself. When I'm not shitting myself, and I'm just going for it and climbing as hard as I can. That's when I'm in flow state for sure.
I'm also guilty of shitting myself sometimes when climbing, so you're not the only one. Yeah, for sure. And does that, I mean, do you get that adrenaline hit when your feet do touch the ground? Is that still something that happens, you know, on every occasion? Is that part of the rush?
No, I mean, I think Alex Honnold said it in the interviews as well, but the adrenaline only comes if something's gone wrong. Otherwise, no, there won't be. Maybe at like a new exit point, I did a free fall into a gorge. And so you've got cliffs either side of you. So if your parachute opens on the wrong heading, like you're going to hit the cliff. So you have to open directly on heading. You have to be quick to land. And if you have a 180, you're stuck because you're just going into these rapids or hit the wall. So something like that, I might have a little bit of adrenaline on the exit point. And I often say that you should never have like a fuck it moment, like where you just go, whatever, fuck it, jump. But every now and again, I do have a fuck it moment, just do it. and that's probably when a little bit of adrenaline happens. But when you have a near miss, that is definitely when you get an adrenaline hit.
Yeah, can imagine. Tim, I'm going to round off now with my final question. I was reading a quote on your website blog, which was describing your recent climb of the Matterhorn, and this really resonated with me. And the quote was, "There is no perfect time. Something can always be improved, the conditions, the weather, the gear you have, the preparation, but now is better than never." Is that a philosophy you live by? And I wonder what you could say about that philosophy that may help other people with their own big goals.
I think I wrote that because I often do just wait out and wait and wait, and I'm just looking for that perfect opportunity. But yeah, it never, the stars don't align that well. So now and again, you just got to go for it. And that also comes into doing solo stuff for me. Like I said, I don't enjoy going out and just you know, doing something by myself completely. But I'm actually probably going to do something like that next week because the stars aren't aligning. I can't find a partner. I can't find this. So I'm just going to go for it by myself. But advice for people that really want to go out and get stuff done is, for me, would just be, it doesn't matter how big your goal is. You know, everyone's ambitions and everyone's abilities are different. So you shouldn't compare yourself to somebody who's climbing Everest, because your Everest could be your local hill, you know? So although, I might find it inspiring that somebody solos K2 without oxygen, it's just as inspiring with somebody with lesser abilities to climb, you know, something in Scotland. So it's not about the goal, it's how much you push yourself, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great way to round off the conversation. Yeah, I've absolutely loved the chat, Tim. It's been great to catch up with you. Yeah,
let's go on a trip sometime.
We definitely need to get on a trip somewhere. Yeah, I can't promise I'll be base jumping, but I'll definitely be having an adventure. Always keen for that. Yeah, so man. Cheers, Tim.
Cool. Cheers, bud. Have a good one.
Well, there you have it, Tim Howell. What a privilege to sit down and speak with him. He's clearly somebody who has an incredible hold over risk and over his fear. And it was fascinating to hear about the level of control, the level of detail that goes into the planning and execution of these big goals. He's somebody I highly recommend you checking out. If you haven't already, definitely give him a follow on Instagram, and you really need to watch some of his videos. It is extraordinary, mind-blowing stuff. So, thanks, Tim. I can't wait to see what the future holds for you. And yes, we're going to make that adventure happen. one day soon. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Wild Edge podcast. It's been a pleasure and a privilege as always, and I do hope that it's injected a bit of a spark, a few new ideas, and a little dose of adventure into your day. So, thank you, and I will look forward to catching you on the next episode. We have a couple of interesting guests coming up in the weeks to come. So make sure you're subscribed. Have a good one, and I'll catch you next time.